to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, June 15. I'm your reader, Ken Louder. First, let's take a look at the local weather for eastern Iowa. Today, we're expecting a partly cloudy day with perhaps some isolated showers. Cedar Rapids will climb to a high of 79 and 80 in Iowa City, falling to a low this evening of 62 in Cedar Rapids and 63 in Iowa City. Sunset tonight is at 8:44 p.m. Sunrise tomorrow at 5:31 a.m. for a total daylight period of 15 hours and 13 minutes. The top story from the front page today is entitled Drowning Worries Rise as City Poodle Pools Stay Idle. This is a story by Aaron Jordan of the Gazette staff. With many public swimming pools closed because of the COVID-19, how do Eastern Iowans stay cool and safe? Public health officials worry this summer will bring more drownings as people swim in lakes, rivers, or backyard pools, which all lack lifeguards. Three people drowned last week alone in eastern Iowa waterways, prompting warnings from the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We have big concerns about drowning deaths if people can't go to a pool, said Dustin Hendricks, supervisor for environmental quality for Linn County Public Health. Iowa had 25 unintentional drowning deaths in 2018, the most recent year reported by the Iowa Department of Public Health. Nationwide, more than 1,000 children drowned in 2016, according to a report from Safe Kids Worldwide. Open water drownings made up 43% of those childhood drownings, compared with 38% in pools and 9% in bathtubs. 10% were unspecified, Safe Kids Worldwide reported. Boys make up 80% of open water swimming deaths, the report showed. Open water, which includes lakes, ponds, and rivers, is less likely to have lifeguards and more likely to have hidden hazards, such as sudden drop-offs, vegetation, and murky water that makes it hard to find a person who slips under. Makita Scott, age 21, of Iowa City, died June 7 at Lake McBride. Her body was not found until the next day, despite people seeing her go underwater and emergency personnel searching for hours. Sharon Kahn, age 64, and Vicki K. Hodges, 44, both of West Union, were tubing June 8 down the Turkey River when they went over a dam in Claremont and drowned, officials said. Concerns over spreading COVID-19 and occupancy limits set by Governor Kim Reynolds have kept many eastern Iowa public swimming pools from opening this summer. A solution for some is adding a backyard pool. The city of Marion, which requires permits for pools over 24 inches deep or more than 5,000 gallons of water, issued 16 pool permits from March 1 through June 5, up from 5 during the same period in 2019 and 10 in 2018. We have a lot of people call in asking questions about whether they need a permit for a pool and how to get those permits, said Ama Bartlett, Marion Administrative Assistant. I'm betting there will be a lot more applications coming still. Cedar Rapids has approved 12 permits since March 1, up slightly from 7 in 2019 and 11 in 2018. In Iowa City and Coralville, permits for in-ground pools have been flat, but Tim Hennis, Iowa City Senior Building Inspector, said he thinks a lot more people are buying above-ground pools from stores like Walmart and Lowe's. James McIntosh, owner of McIntosh Pools in Solon, said its schedule for installing in-ground pools this summer is filling quickly. In late February or early March, I wasn't necessarily seeing the huge lead generation. Then, middle and end of March, it just kind of exploded, McIntosh said of the interest. Dewey and Michael Abramoff of Iowa City decided last summer to have an in-ground pool installed in their backyard this year, getting on McIntosh Pool's schedule well before the COVID-19 pandemic. We are really lucky we decided last fall, and they started this spring because the pool installers, are full for this summer, Dewey Abramoff said. She expects the family will use the saltwater pool every day this summer, especially because so many events and activities have been canceled. Pools within city limits usually are required to have a fence, so children or other unsupervised swimmers don't fall into the water. Automatic safety pool covers, solid enough for an adult to walk on without falling into the pool, are another way to keep out unsupervised swimmers. When they are closed, the pool is covered and locked, McIntosh said. In some ways, it's safer than a fence. The state public health department recommends keeping children under age 5 within arm's reach, using life jackets for young swimmers, and not drinking alcohol when swimming or supervising children. Splash pads at 11 Cedar Rapids parks could open as soon as this week if Reynolds' proclamation closing them until Wednesday ends as expected, according to Scott Hawk, the city's Parks and Recreation Director. At this time, we are planning to operate them under the same guidelines as playgrounds, Hawk said in an email, with signage recommending that people do not use them if they are ill, practice social distancing, and wash their hands or use hand sanitizer after use. Officials are looking for other ways for residents to cool off on hot summer days. The Parks and Recreation Department is working with the Cedar Rapids Fire Department to explore opening fire hydrants as sprayers, Hawk said. This would be done when the city's Roland Recmobile visits 13 parks 6 days a week from June 22 to August 14. The Recmobile will be a van loaded with recreation equipment and games and equipped with Wi-Fi people can use during park visits. Henrik said he's looking into whether there is grant money available to buy hoses and sprinklers that Linn County could put out in parks or possibly give residents for their own backyards. Also from the front page, a student editor exposes racial gap in Iowa City schools. Iowa City graduate, City High graduate earns a national honor for her findings. This is a story by Sarah Watson of the Gazette staff. In Iowa City High's first ethnic studies class, student journalist Nina Lovezzo-Stakopoulos heard some disturbing facts. In 2014, the state ranked third in the nation for locking up a disproportionate share of black Iowans, and nationwide school disciplinary policies contribute to a pipeline to juvenile and criminal justice systems. As a conversation with friends in the library turned to talk of suspensions in the Iowa City Community School District, a seed was planted. Lovezzo-Stakopoulos decided to investigate. After 3 weeks of researching district statistics and interviewing classmates and administrators, Lovezzo-Stakopoulos produced a roughly 2,500-word story that found black students district-wide were nearly twice as likely to be suspended from school as their white peers. This month, the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights Organization, based in Washington, D.C., awarded Lovezzo-Stakopoulos its top high school journalism award at a virtual ceremony. The award, presented by television journalist Katie Couric, came with a $500 check and a bust of Kennedy. The organization awards outstanding champions of moral courage who stand up to oppression. The New York Times profiled the now-graduated co-editor of the Little Hawk, City High's student newspaper. It was kind of mind-blowing, Lovezzo-Stakopoulos said. Just the past couple of months with my graduating, in a pandemic, a revolution happening, Black Lives Matter, my life feels very weird right now. On top of that, being interviewed for the New York Times is a little hard to process, but it felt satisfying to be recognized by such a well-known organization for my work. City High Principal John Bacon said he's proud of Lovezzo-Stakopoulos for shedding light on district-wide disparities, a gap he said City High is working to close. City High changed its suspension policies in recent years to be more objective, he said. Students can be suspended only for physical violence or for having a weapon or possessing controlled substances. The school also began a 2-year implicit bias training program for faculty. She absolutely deserves the award, he said. We know we have more work to do. Her story is a call for continued action until that problem is truly solved. In the process of publishing the article and afterward, Lovezos Stakopoulos said she underwent tense conversations with administrators, whom Bacon said wanted to clarify the school's policy that athletic team discipline and school suspension would be done only with direct factual evidence rather than speculation. She interviewed the principal, assistant principal, and the dean of students. Despite heart-wrenching interviews with black students about their experiences being disciplined and pushback from administrators, she knew the story's importance was worth traversing a complicated and emotional topic. After the story went to print, Latasha Deloach, a former Iowa City school board member, vice chair of the state's Disproportionate Minority Contact Committee, and a source in the story, asked for Lovezos Stakopoulos' autograph on the printed edition. The Little Hawks advisor, Jonathan Rogers, said he was impressed with the leadership of Lovezos Stakopoulos and co-editor Mira Kumar. The 50-person Little Hawk staff puts out 6 issues a year and won the 2019 All-Iowa News Team of the Year Award. He said he couldn't be prouder of Lovezos Stakopoulos' award, adding that he hopes positive change will come of it. "My advice is always seek truth and report it," he said. Also from the front page, a story by Sarah Watson of the Gazette staff, "Nonprofit raises money to cover protester bails. We don't want to reproduce the existing unfairness." In Iowa City and beyond, racial justice protesters have written a phone number on their arms and painted the 10 digits on poster board and car windows just in case. On the other end of the line is a volunteer for the Eastern Iowa Community Bond Project, a nonprofit that in a matter of days raised tens of thousands of dollars to pay bail for arrested protesters in Iowa. The fund hasn't paid bail for the few arrested protesters in Iowa City or Cedar Rapids, as most were released on their own promise to return for court, project organizer Julia Zelensky said. However, the organization has doled out $47,000 to pay for 61 arrested protesters' release from jails across Iowa in the group's effort to help people who don't have the funds to pay to be released and to support continuing Black Lives Matter protests. The funds raised reflect a nationwide movement to donate to bail funds and organizations that offer masks, food, water, and legal advice for Black Lives Matter protesters. The Minnesota Freedom Fund raised $20 million in 4 days. As Minnesota protests swelled and some clashes with law enforcement ended in arrests in the wake of George Floyd's killing by a Minnesota police officer, a groundswell of small-dollar donations padded the Eastern Iowa Fund's $175,000 raised in its Free the Protesters campaign, Zelensky said. Only 7 people were arrested between May 30 and June 9 in connection to or nearby Iowa City protests, which have drawn thousands of people, according to Iowa City data. In an email, Sergeant Brad Kunkel, public information officer for the Johnson County Sheriff's Office, said 5 people had been arrested in connection to the Iowa City protests since June 1. In Johnson and Linn counties, jail officials have taken steps to reduce the number of inmates to stop the spread of COVID-19, including directing officers to reconsider arrests. The Bond Project was created in 2017 after President Donald Trump's election to fund bail for immigrant detainees. Since the group had the process and knowledge in place, Zelensky said organizers turned their energy to raising funds for future arrested protesters. Bail, or a bond arranged through a professional bail bondsman, is money or property that's forfeited to the court if an accused person doesn't appear for trial. Like a loan to the court, it's returned if the person makes his or her court appearances. Zelensky said that system stacks the cards against those who can't afford to pay. When you pay a bond, you're not getting someone out who would never have gotten out otherwise. You're getting someone out who would get out if they were wealthier, she said. She said the organization has seen arrested protester bails ranging from $2,000 for criminal mischief to property damage at a felony level at $5,000. Simple misdemeanor bail amounts are set lower, typically $300, she said. Bail for an assault on an officer charge could be around $1,500 to $2,000, she said. Due to the amount the group raised, it hasn't set stipulations on which charges for which it would pay bail. We don't want to reproduce the existing unfairness where a white protester does something that's not perceived as assaultive behavior and a black protester does the exact same thing and it is perceived as assaultive behavior, she said. She said a core group of about 6 volunteers will wait for a call or text with a location and name, most often from protest organizers or leaders. Then they coordinate how much money is needed and identify someone who can pay the bail, which sometimes means a volunteer has to drive hours to the county where the person is being held. Although most protesters' charges are eventually dropped, Zelensky said, fronting the cost to remove people from jail could reduce their risk of spreading COVID-19 in close-quartered spaces. It's just double, triple, extra important to get people out right now, regardless of what they've been charged with, Zelensky said. Turning to today's opinion page, we have a guest column from Mandy Nichols. Mandy Nichols is the director of Corridor Community Action Network, and her column is entitled "Protests Are More Than Spray Paint and Blocked Traffic." Nearly everyone in the Iowa City area knows something about the recent nighttime protests. The movement is visible, loud, and permeating local mainstream media. Yet there are so many things people aren't hearing about, so many stories that aren't being told. I'm not seeing anything about the many businesses, organizations, and individuals offering safe places to rest, as well as water and other supplies, outside of their own social media pages. I'm not hearing people talk about how incredibly well the protesters look out for each other, ensuring that everyone is adequately protected and cared for with masks, water, and food. The sheer numbers in the streets make the unity behind this movement undeniable. That same unity exists in individual interactions, such as when someone was stopped by the Johnson County Sheriff's Office while dropping off supplies near the Pentagrest, and other protesters responded instantly, unloading the supplies and handing the driver cash. While I had no doubts, the Iowa Freedom Riders' support for their followers was made blatantly clear when they covered the rest of the cost of that tow the next day. Anyone who has seen the spray paint or heard the chants, while failing to fully grasp the deep sense of community and urgency behind this critical movement, needs to hear these stories. They also need to learn about the sound reasoning based on the reality of life, not only here in the United States in general, but here in this town, that is behind the Iowa Freedom Riders' demands. They are doing important work in getting the attention of a community and a government that has ignored serious systemic problems for far too long. And it's working. The attention is there. People are responding, the media is responding, the city council is responding, yet the response is not enough, and the media need to be more accountable about making sure that people are getting important information. Protests are demanding changes that are known to be associated with improving equity and decreasing racial disparities. They are demanding reasonable steps to improve diversity and inclusion within every city department and the school board, as well as other institutions and businesses. Diverse and inclusive organizations have been shown to make better decisions, to be more innovative, and to have employees who are more engaged in their work and have better performance, all things this city needs. The Iowa Freedom Riders' demands also include a clear and sensible plan for affordable housing. According to the 2018 Out of Reach Iowa report, 40% of all Iowa renters are housing cost burdened. It is one of the many obvious issues that need to be addressed immediately. Perhaps even more crucial is the protesters' demand for a restructuring of the Iowa City Police Department toward community policing. Camden, New Jersey made such a shift in 2013, and the results have been astounding, with a 95% decrease in complaints of excessive force since 2014. This is critical given the significant problem our country has with police violence. Per capita, 6 times as many people die in police custody in the United States than in Britain. In 2018, police in this country fatally shot 992 people during a year in which there were 11 such deaths in Germany and 8 in Australia. Not only do our officers kill far more people than those in other countries, they also kill black people at a much higher rate than any other ethnicity. 30 per million of the population between 2015 and June 2020, compared to 12 per million of the white population. Looking at all of those statistics, there is no acceptable excuse for not taking steps proven to decrease the use of excessive force and to give an independent review board, such as the Community Police Review Board, more power. Related to current policing system problems is the Iowa Freedom Riders' demand that all school resource officers be removed from public schools. Officers' presence contributes to a school-to-prison pipeline that has a disproportionately negative impact on the black community, with a higher rate of referrals to law enforcement and of school-related arrests. In general, students in schools with SROs are 5 times more likely to be arrested than students in schools without them. Our children do not need to be arrested. They need to be educated. Part of that education should include anti-racist curriculum and the complete teaching of black history in America. That is what we need to decrease systemic racism, not only in our schools, but in future generations. The demand that Governor Kim Reynolds decriminalize marijuana is exceptionally important in Iowa, the state that ranks 5th worst in the nation for racial disparities in marijuana arrests. In Iowa, a black person is 7.3 times more likely to be arrested for possession of marijuana than a white person, even though both groups use marijuana at the same rate. That is an unacceptable stain on our state that needs to be addressed now. Making possession of marijuana unarrestable would go a long way toward decreasing disparities. These protests are far more than the spray paint, marching, and the traffic blocking receiving so much coverage. Those actions were necessary to get the public and government's attention. It now is time for that attention to be focused on the demands and the logic behind them, and on the needs of a community that is coming together in unprecedented ways to get its message heard. And that column by Mandy Nichols, the director of the Corridor Community Action Network. We have two letters to the editor today. The first one comes from Susan Blocker of Cedar Rapids. Susan's letter is entitled, "Donald Trump and Joe Biden are a study in contrast." On a recent Monday morning, Joe Biden met with community leaders at an Episcopal church in Delaware. For nearly an hour, he respectfully listened to their anguish and concern about racism and inequality in America. He followed with a speech Tuesday, offering solutions, sound proposals, and words of healing for a nation divided. Donald Trump, meanwhile, ordered national police to forcibly break up a peaceful demonstration in Washington, D.C. Demonstrators scrambled to escape tear gas and flash bombs. Clergy at nearby St. John's Church, distributing water and medical attention to demonstrators, were driven off the church grounds by shield-bearing police. Why? So Trump could walk there and use a Bible as a prop for a photo op. Please let that sink in. He put people in harm's way by inciting a mass exodus and had others removed from their own house of worship, just so he could have his photo taken. He followed with incendiary tweets, name-calling, and racist dog whistles. One of these demonstrates presidential leadership and courage, the other, narcissism and cowardice. I sincerely pray that in the coming months, Americans can discern the difference. That letter by Susan Blocker of Cedar Rapids. The next letter comes from Edward Wasserman of Iowa City. His letter is entitled, Senator Ernst's evasion signifies acquiescence. Quote, I love America more than any other country in the world, and exactly for this reason, I insist on the right to criticize her perpetually, end quote. So said James Baldwin, author and activist. On June 1, Donald Trump flagrantly violated the First Amendment of the Constitution by unleashing heavily armed forces to gas, club, and trample peaceful protesters who were lawfully assembling to criticize abusive police practices and systemic racism. Trump topped off his shameful abuse of power by staging a photographic stunt in front of a place of worship. A firestorm of condemnation has ensued, which has included searing rebukes from notable military figures, such as former Marine Corps General and Trump's own former Secretary of Defense James Mattis. And what has Iowa's junior senator said about Trump's transgression? Quote, I think we all will do things differently, and the president chose one path, end quote. We expect our elected representatives to uphold their oaths of office, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, not to be bullied into acquiescence. It's time for Iowans to choose a different and more courageous path. Elect Teresa Greenfield for the United States Senate in November. That letter by Edward Wasserman of Iowa City. You're reading, listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, June 15, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. First from Cedar Rapids, Stephen, also known as Pappy Ray Batchelor, Sr., age 72, died Friday, June 12. Private services will be held. Arrangements are with Stuart Baxter, Funeral and Memorial Services in Mount Vernon. From Solon, Quinn A. Fields, age 27, passed away Tuesday, June 9, Mercy Hospital in Iowa City. A public graveside service will be held at 1 p.m. Tuesday, June 16, at Smithtown Cemetery in rural Lost Nation. Family and close friends are invited on Tuesday to attend a visitation at Dawson Funeral Services in Maquoketa, starting at 10:30 a.m. From Cedar Rapids, Olive Pauline Romero, age 92, passed away on Saturday, June 13, at Meadow View Assisted Living. Family will be holding a service at 11 a.m. Wednesday, June 17, with an hour visitation prior to service at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories, burial in Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. And from Marion, Chester, also known as Chet Roy Tremblay, age 71, passed away Tuesday, June 2, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, a cremation has taken place. A joint burial and committal service for Chet and his wife, Diana, will be held at 3 p.m. Thursday, June 18, at Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. A celebration of life service will follow at 5 p.m. Thursday at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion, where the family will greet friends 1 hour prior to the service. Please be mindful of social distancing guidelines, and we request you please provide your own face mask. From Iowa City, the family of Corrine Ashby is saddened to share that the Iowa City resident of 63 years peacefully passed on Sunday, April 12, after a 13-year battle with Alzheimer's disease. Thanks to modern video technology, Corrine was surrounded by her family right up to the end, despite current restrictions on travel and gathering due to COVID-19. Corrine Ashby's family will be having a small and private service on Saturday, June 20 at 11 a.m. Due to COVID-19, only a few family members will be in attendance at the physical service. However, we will be streaming Corrine's service live on Facebook for her friends and family to enjoy. The service also will be saved for later viewing as well. Thanks for your understanding in this new way of joining Corrine's family in remembering Corrine. From Iowa City, Charles Jerome Clarahan, age 85, passed away peacefully on Thursday, June 11, following an extended illness. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, June 16, at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City, where a rosary will be recited at 6:30 p.m., graveside committal services with military honors will be at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, June 17, at St. Joseph's Cemetery. Please respect social distancing. From Cedar Rapids, Richard, also known as Dick Leroy Ingalls, age 82, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Friday, June 12, at his home, surrounded by his loving family. Friends and family may visit and celebrate his life from 1 to 2 p.m. Wednesday, June 17, at the Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories. A private memorial service will be held at the chapel. Interment with military rites will be held at the Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. From Iowa City, Kathleen A., also known as Kathy Fountain, age 81, a lifelong resident of the Iowa City area, died Thursday, June 11, at the Briarwood Care Center in Iowa City. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, June 20, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church in Iowa City. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Friday at Gay and Chia Funeral and Cremation Service. And from Tipton, Jennifer Irene Johnson, age 38, entered eternity at 4:19 a.m. Friday, June 12, at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics in Iowa City from cardiac arrest. Funeral services will be held at 10 a.m. Tuesday, June 16, at the Dietrichson Memorial Football Field located in Tipton's City Park. The bleachers will be for public use, but social distancing is encouraged. A private family burial will follow in the Tipton Masonic Cemetery. Our top sports story today is entitled Thin Ice Ahead, and it's about junior hockey, and it's a story by Jeff Johnson of the Gazette staff from Cedar Rapids. Tom Geraghty was named president and commissioner of the United States Hockey League in May 2018. Spending over a quarter century in sports administration and sales, Geraghty has worked for the NHL's Minnesota Wild and MLB's Houston Astros. He's been CEO and president of the USHL's Sioux Falls Stampede, named the league's executive of the year for the 2014-15 season. Geraghty had a conversation Thursday with the Gazette discussing the premature end of the 2019-2020 season due to the COVID-19 pandemic and hopes for a 2020-2021 season. If it occurs, this season certainly will look different from any in the USHL's 41-year history. Supporting our league is important, Geraghty said. Obviously, Cedar Rapids is a staple of our league. Great organization. Love having them in it. We love having Carly, coach GM Mark Carlson, and owner Tony Sadao, the whole group there. I just think we are encouraged that we are going to be able to drop the puck this upcoming year. We look forward to having people come out. One of the things, too, is that we are using a lot of energy making sure our arenas are safe. We are doing all sorts of social distancing things, along with taking care of the teams. That are a lot of things going on that when the fans do come back, they will be feeling more comfortable with coming back out. We'll get through this and we'll be stronger on the other side. Here's the Gazette's interview with Geraghty. Question: What is the status of the league and resuming league activities? Answer. We're working on a ton of stuff. We have a board of directors meeting on the 18th and 19th via Zoom. So we will be having a massive conversation about restarting things the season. What does that look like? What are the necessary protocols that we will have to put in place for the safety of our players, our fans, and our staff? Lots to do. We have done a lot of work so far on it, but as you mentioned, everything is fluid. Things change daily as far as information. We're learning a lot from the NHL, USA Hockey, our partners, watching what other leagues are doing. Hopefully, we'll be able to put together a plan that we can approve here by mid-July as far as when everything gets back to playing games. Question. Knowing, as you said, everything being fluid here, do you anticipate at some point having a 2020-2021 season? Answer. Yes, we do, yes. Now again, I'm not an infectious disease specialist, but we plan on playing. Lots of things could change that, second waves, state regulations, but we will be following the CDC, not only nationally but locally in all of our communities. We will be working with the cities and the arenas and the owners of each team. We won't play until we know it's safe for our players, our staff, and our fans. But from what we know as of today, we're very encouraged that we will be able to play next year. Question. Cedar Rapids Rough Riders coach and general manager Mark Carlson said he believes his team's tryout camp, ordinarily conducted in June, will be sometime in mid-August now. Every club needs camps, tryout camps, and so on, sooner rather than later. Where is the league with allowing those? Answer. Again, we work directly with each team. We've got a very detailed set of protocols that teams are mandated to do, to provide safety for the kids and themselves. We're working on a daily basis with each team's general manager, coaches, going through protocols, making sure they have a detailed plan, making sure they have everything that we need, that we know as of today they need to do to be done. I think if all of those things are approved by the city, approved by the arena, and approved by the local folks, medical staffs, as long as those things are connected, we feel comfortable that teams can host their camps. Question. Obviously, you don't have the big television deals that major league sports have. Clubs rely on ticket sales to exist. Therefore, I would assume that would mean there would be no way games ever would be played without fans. Answer. Never say never. But what I mean by that is what you said is extremely accurate. We are a gate-driven league. We do stream games online, but teams from a business side live through ticket sales, season tickets, individual tickets, local sponsorships. People buy popcorn and hot dogs, buy merchandise. So without fans, it would be extremely difficult to see us play. There are always options, but I'm comfortable telling you that. Question. What kind of a financial impact has this pandemic had on league franchises? Do you expect every club that ended the abbreviated 2019-2020 season being active for the 2020-2021 season? Answer. It was a significant financial kick to the teeth, so to speak. But I think the thing I was proud about our owners was they understood this was much bigger than playing sports. They made all the decisions that you would hope all of your owners would do, not thinking about dollars and cents, but thinking about safety. So even though we lost a lot of games and playoffs, some teams lost as many as 8 or 9 home games, which is a third of their season, plus potential playoff revenue, they still decided to do the right thing, which was to shut our season down and take care of our communities, to do what we need to do that right. But yeah, it was a major, significant blow to these teams. Question, if everything is as it is now, would you start the season on time in late September or early October, or would you move it back some? Answer. As of today, we're planning on starting the season as normal, but with the caveat that we have contingency plans based on what we hear over the course of the next 2 or 3 months. Starting with our board call next week, we will have the decision of, okay, this is what things look like starting in October with the fall classic that we always launch in Pittsburgh. But over the course of every other week now, we will have meetings that will determine if that targeted date still is accurate. If we need to adjust, we will look at November, we will look at December. Whatever our cities and our communities are telling us that they want us to do to keep everybody safe, we will adhere to those rules. Question: what has this situation been like for you personally? Answer: it has been really frustrating in some ways, but looking at the whole situation, it's hard not to feel anything but empathy, really understanding that people are losing their lives. There are a lot of sick people. It is affecting everyone in the world, so you try and put things in perspective. We know we are going to play hockey again. The positives have been the galvanization of our league, seeing how stable our group of owners are, seeing how strong they are, our great relationships with the NHL and USA Hockey. Those have been extremely positive. Working together on solutions, making sure we are taking care of these 16 to 20-year-old young men that we are responsible for and doing the right things, showing the United States and all of junior hockey why we are the top league. Those have been very encouraging. Like everybody else, I'm jonesing to get back to work and going into an arena to watch hockey. Our Dear Abby today is entitled Friends Abandon Mom After Third Child. Dear Abby, I recently welcomed my third child, a baby boy. We are overjoyed. Our two daughters are almost 10 years old. Through the years, my social circle has consisted mostly of the parents of my daughter's friends. My news led to mixed reactions. Some were thrilled for my pregnancy. Others were shocked. One woman even told me, "I'm just not in that phase of life anymore." After my son was born, I didn't get visits or even a phone call from some of them. I'm trying to focus on the positives. We have a big family on both sides, and many people within our community have warmly welcomed him. But I've been a good friend to these women, supported them in their times of need, and reached out during the pandemic to check on them and reconnect. I'm so disappointed. What am I supposed to say to these friends when I run into them again? And that's signed, New Mom Again. And Abby responds, Dear Mom, make polite conversation and ask how they and their families are doing. If they inquire, tell them you and your family are well. Then move on, recognizing you are dealing with people centered only on themselves. Do not attempt to revive a relationship with anyone who cares so little about you that they would treat you as they have. But do recognize how fortunate you are that you know not to invest more of your time or yourself in them. From today's community page, the lead article there is entitled Voices of Protest. It's an article by Diana Nolan of the Gazette staff. Iowans of all ages and races can add their voices to unwavering 21st century activism. Opening September 19 at the African American Museum of Iowa. Located at 55 12th Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, the museum is set to reopen Fridays and Saturdays starting July 10. While the unwavering exhibit reflects the current state of unrest, the subject matter was decided upon long before the death of George Floyd sparked global protests. Staff discussions began 2 years ago, and the theme was chosen a year ago, said Lanisha Castle, the museum's executive director. Even the idea of asking for public thoughts and experiences on activism came before Floyd died May 25, after a Minneapolis police officer knelt on his neck for nearly 9 minutes. Castle credits the call for online community comments to summer intern Jennifer Miller, a doctoral student in language, literacy, and culture at the University of Iowa. The exhibit, created by museum staff members, will highlight Black Lives Matter and other contemporary movements affecting black civil rights issues in Iowa, including the hashtag MeToo and protests for athletic and LGBTQ rights. According to the museum's website, visitors will learn how these movements build upon the fight for black civil rights and equality that started over a century ago, and the ways that technology and social media have shaped modern activism. The museum is also collecting signs from Iowa protests that may be incorporated into the exhibit or programming in conjunction with the exhibit. For donation guidelines and to ensure safe handling, email curator Felicity Wolf at fwolfe@blackiowa.org. We don't need 1,000 of them, but it would be great to have some from across the state, Castle said, noting that photos are welcome too. I've seen images from protests, dynamic, powerful images that people have captured already. The deadline is July 1 for the Unwavering Writing Project online submissions to allow for incorporating the words into the September exhibit. The general idea is to be able to take the data that we get from the writing and create a visual that's accessible or representative in a three-dimensional art piece or a visual tag cloud or some form of interactive digital presence, Castle said. The information even could be used to do programming throughout the run of the exhibit. We don't want to limit it to one specific thing, but to utilize the data that we get for multiple efforts around the length of the exhibit. Participants can respond to any or all of 5 themes outlined at blackiowa.org/unwavering-visual-writing-project. The first is living in the present. Think about current events taking place in our nation and state. What does present-day activism look like to you? What different types of activism have you seen and practiced in recent weeks? Next, honoring the past. Consider the roots of your activism. What is the deeper origin of your daily actions? How does your life follow in the footsteps of those who came before you? Next, imagining the future. What types of activism would you like to see here in Iowa and around the world? Can you imagine new forms of activism that will change our world? Meditate on the future. What do you envision? Can you imagine new forms of arts, activism, fashion activism, sports activism, environmental activism, or political activism? Next, blind spots. What blind spots have you noticed in yourself or in other people when it comes to activism? Have you been able to address some of your own blind spots? What forms of activism are the most powerful in addressing the blind spots of others? Next, comfort zones. Sometimes certain situations or specific places can make you feel more or less comfortable as activists. What situations and places make you feel the most uncomfortable, and why? Do you believe activism should take people out of their comfort zones? The project is open to anyone, regardless of age, culture, or experience, Castle said. We definitely would love it to be an Iowa tie. I don't think it would be necessarily a bad thing if we got something from someone in from Canada wanting to participate. But our focus is Iowa, so it would be great to draw that line back to what exists here in our state. We would love to hear youth express their thoughts and stories as well, she added. I think it's great. Children, even young children, are being empowered to share their voices right now. The project also underscores that the museum is more than a portal to the past. We've really been trying to focus on relevancy, Castle said. We're trying to keep up and let people know we aren't just preserving history that's from a couple hundred years ago, but we're looking at what's happening right now. The museum will look to the past in a different way this year, celebrating the end of slavery in America with a virtual Juneteenth events Monday through Friday this week in lieu of the day-long event planned before the COVID-19 shutdown. We tried to mimic what we would have done if we would have had a live event where we would have had where we would have an MC, stage performances, vendors, and food, Castle said. Those components will be offered online throughout the week, featuring recordings of praise dance, rap, spoken word, singing, remarks by vendors and sponsors, as well as links to their sites. Special features include a tour inside a mobile barbershop, a conversation with Dr. Sharon Collins on physical and mental health at this time, and opera star Simon Estes reading part of Martin Luther King's speech, The Other America, given several times beginning in 1967 and addressing race, poverty, and economic justice. At 7 p.m. Friday, contestants can join a Juneteenth trivia fundraiser for the museum, focusing on Juneteenth and Black accomplishments in American history and popular culture. The suggested donation is $10 per player. And the sidebar called At a Glance, What? African American Museum of Iowa is at 55 12th Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. The writing project is called Unwavering, A 21st Century Activism in Iowa, seeking public contributions by July 1. Submitted at blackiowa.org/unwavering-virtual-writing-project. And Juneteenth, virtual programming Monday through Friday. Details at blackiowa.org/Juneteenth and social media platforms. And finally, museum reopening. July 10, open noon to 6 p.m. Fridays, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Saturdays, and masks are required. Admission is $6 for adults, $5 for seniors, $3.50 for students and youths, and free under age 5 and museum members. And in Eastern Iowa Briefs, the first from Cedar Rapids is entitled Roland Wreckmobile Coming to 13 City Parks. Even though the city's Parks and Recreation Department has canceled youth programs scheduled to start this month because of social distancing and safety concerns for staff and participants, the Roland Wreckmobile will be up and running, tentatively slated to start June 22. This mobile recreation program will bring recreation opportunities to neighborhoods. It will operate 6 days a week, visiting 2 to 3 parks each day. A schedule of park stops will be available at crrec.org when the program begins. During the initial phase, families will be able to pick up projects and activities to do together, in the park or at home. As social distancing requirements ease, participants will gather in small groups for activities a safe distance apart. Finally, when safe to do so, the program will provide large group recreation, including sports, games, fitness classes, reading opportunities, displaying animals from Old McDonald's Farm, and more. The Rolling Wreckmobile will stop at Beaver, Cedar Valley, Cherry Hill, Cleveland, Daniels, Hayes, Hitter, Green Square, Jacqueline, Jones, Knoll Ridge, Redmond, and Time Check Parks. Each of the park stops will include free food options and an opportunity to use free Wi-Fi from the van. The program is funded by a $10,698 grant from the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation and a $6,000 donation from the Cedar Rapids Kiwanis. And Families Helping Families Collecting School Supplies. Families Helping Families of Iowa is collecting school supply donations to provide new, fully stocked backpacks for more than 500 children in foster care, relative placement, or who were adopted from foster care. Each year, we partner with 30 local businesses to host school supply drives on our behalf. Due to COVID-19, most of these businesses remain closed with their employees working remotely. This caused us to think outside the box to come up with a virtual way to collect supplies this year, said Melissa Carlson, Executive Director. Donations will be collected until July 24 and can be shipped to Families Helping Families at 3516 Center Point Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids. For a list of supply needs and link to an Amazon shopping list, go to fhfia.org and click on events. Financial donations can also be made online at fhfia.org. Select 2020 Back to School Rally or the donation form. For more information, email office@fhfia.org or call 319-294-9706. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Monday, June 15. I'm your reader, Ken Lauder. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org at any time. And thank you for listening.